Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
It is so confusing, the amount of corruption, which is why I've asked Chad Thomas to join us on the show this morning and to take us through what really has gone on there and what is the real story with a CEO of IRS Forensic Investigation. Chad Thomas, a very good morning. How are you?
Howard, how are you? I feel much the same as you. It's so confusing. It's so incestuous. There's so much going on. And at the moment, it's really dominating the news cycle. And we have to start trying to understand what's happening. Where do the commissions fit in? Where does the investigative director of the NPA sit in? How are the hawks involved? Where does the SIU come into play? Why are some people being charged? Why are others not being charged? And it can cause a little bit of confusion.
Yeah, I mean, and why is the NEC even bothering to meet? They've known this is coming. They've surely got the statement prepared, spell checked, and ready to go.
It's a strange situation. You had Iqbal Surveys publishing group come out a couple of weeks ago stating as fact that there was, in fact, an arrest warrant for Ace Magashule. So that was almost a way of preparing the masses, etc., that, look, this is going to happen. It's not going to come as a surprise because obviously at that time there wasn't a warrant of arrest. If one looks at this warrant of arrest that's been issued, it's dated 10 November. And if one looks at the correspondence between the DPCI and the attorneys for record for Mr. Magashule, his anticipated court appearance is this Friday the 13th. And it's bizarre that the IOL, the Independent Online, together with the Independent Newspaper Group, came out weeks ago saying that there's already a warrant. And that, to me, is not a case of being forewarned or forearmed. It's a case of preparing the public so that they can lay the ground to creating a specific narrative around this of, once again, victimization of somebody who's there for the people, who stood for the people, and now has been picked on. And the bizarre thing is Magashule holds an exceptionally powerful position within the party. He is the by all intents and purposes, he is the head of party business, which is why he sits as Secretary General at the Thule House. He's responsible for electioneering. He's responsible for policy. He's responsible for procedures. And as somebody who arguably holds the second most powerful position in the party, second only to the president, based on the fact that he's responsible for party business, it smacks of being decisive enough. When the NEC had decided in a resolution that anybody should be charged with corruption needs to step aside, that they're now looking to argue that there should be a concession made for Magashule, and that's going to cause problems.
Right. So but of course we can anticipate exactly what's going to happen. The ANC are going to say, well, you know, he is innocent until proven guilty. We've got to go through this process. Yes, we take corruption very seriously, but in the meantime, very little will happen. I mean, that's what I anticipated. Do you think it will be any different this time round? Do you think the ANC is actually finally recognizing that people have had enough of them and they've got this major credibility problem?
I don't know. It's a situation that every case that's come forward, there's been some or other damage control or spin. And the party's in a position now where they're out of spin. They can't write the narrative any longer. They can't claim the victim card. There's been grand scale corruption. I always say there's been a symbiotic relationship between the public and private sector criminals with the ultimate aim being the plunder of the public purse. Mm. And when one looks at what's happening in the private sector with regards to people that are saying mea culpa, we had the confession and the guilty plea that was accepted in respect of the CFO of VBS. And we look at what happens within corporate versus government, where if somebody is accused of such a huge impropriety, they step aside while the investigation is taking place. One would expect the party to do the same thing, especially somebody who's in charge of party business, who's in charge of raising the funds, who's in charge of paying the salaries. He is the most senior person when it comes to the way in which the party is run and managed from the Thule House. I wanted to change direction slightly and just talk about the warrant of arrest and the bizarre nature of this whole process.
Absolutely.
Normally, allegations get made against an accused. So Somebody will believe that a party's been prejudiced. Statements will be made to the authorities, and the case will be investigated. The investigating officer will take the case to the National Prosecuting Authority to look at. If they believe that there's a prima facie case, they'll put instructions on the docket asking for further information. And then something very interesting happens. South Africa, of course, the right to being presumed innocent is sacrosanct. It's contained within our constitution. So they allow what's called the audi alteram partem rule to come into play, which means they give somebody the right to reply. And normally the way in which that's done, if somebody's cooperating, is they call that person in and they give them what's known as a warning statement. And in that warning statement, it's a two-part document. The first part is to warn somebody of their rights. We watch television a lot. We've seen in America, they call it the Miranda rights, and everybody talks about being Mirandized. Well, in South Africa, it's called judge's rules, and it's very similar. You get advised what your rights are. You don't have to talk. You don't have to self-incriminate yourself. You have the right to an attorney. But you can, if you want, on this particular document where you've now signed that you've been told what your rights are, you can give your version of events. You can do this to expedite the process. You can be totally innocent for all intents and purposes, and you want to show that you're innocent, and you can then fill in a certain portion of this document and give your version of events. This then goes back to the prosecutor, because it's the investigating officer who takes this warning statement. And then they look at this document and they see whether you gave your version of events. Sometimes your attorney may have added representations to this, why this matter shouldn't be enrolled, and they then weigh it up and they determine whether or not they're going to enroll the matter. They're only going to enroll a matter if there's a prima facie case. If at first glance it seems that the allegations that have made have substance to it. And then something interesting happens. The person would normally be given what's called a J175, a subpoena to appear in court on a specific day to answer to those charges. They don't normally go straight to a J50, which is a warrant of arrest. J50 warrant of arrest is to ensure that somebody appears in court. It means that should they fail to appear in court, they don't have to apply for a bench warrant from the presiding officer. They can immediately instruct the investigating officer to now take that warrant and to go out and arrest somebody. And it's very strange that they went straight to warrant of arrest. Normally what we've seen is that you can get called in, you can get processed, you can go before the magistrate. Alternatively, you can be served with a J175 and go in. What the NPA, through the investigative directorate, are showing is that they're exceptionally serious about this. It's highly unusual, in my opinion, as somebody who conducts criminal investigations, for them to have gone straight to a warrant of arrest without going via the J175 route, which is a subpoena firsthand.
So would they have done that because it's that important for the public, or because the case is so clearly a very strong one in their view? Or both?
I think both those points are very valid, and I think both those points come into play. And I think there's a third. I think the third is that there has to be a little bit of Hollywood. The fact that we've seen those warrants now circulating, we've seen those documents from the DPCR circulating, it's almost as if to say, listen here, have faith in us. We are who we say we are. We're the investigative director. We're going to make sure that people are held accountable, and we're going to throw the full might of the law at them. We're not going to wait. We're not going to let people come in and waste time or come with sick notes. You are coming to court whether you like it or not. What we are going to do is we're going to give you one concession. We're not going to come to your door with lights blazing like you claimed we were going to do.
Yeah, Linda was very upset by that. Linda, you wanted that.
We're going to put you on the ground and handcuff you in front of the cameras.
But Linda needed that.
We're going to give you the opportunity to come. But if you don't come, we've got the warrant ready.
Right. Yeah, you see, Lindy's upset with that. She wanted that up. She wanted those visuals, didn't you?
I needed it.
You needed it.
To have a great week.
And you know why it's an issue? Because of the scorpions. The scorpions did a great job in many instances, but they took the Hollywood a little bit too far sometimes. And people feel like it's playing to one group. Now, you must remember, you've got a very factionalized party. You've got a party at the moment that isn't sitting around the same table singing Kumbaya.
Right, right.
And this factionalized party, some people want to see the flashing lights. And if they see the flashing lights and they start sticking everybody's faces, you see, we told you so. Factionalizes the party even more so. And then suddenly we're back to square one where we were with the scorpions, where people say that the independent the investigative directorate rather is being used to settle political scores, and we don't want that to happen. We want these to be apolitical prosecutions.
Carol Zimmerman saying, what an informative explanation, so refreshing. It really is to just to hear it from your perspective and just to try and understand the process. Before we talk about other things, can we go back to the actual case? What are the allegations being made against Ace Magashule here?
So it's a strange one. There's so many cases, and people would have thought perhaps it was the Frieda Dairy matter, or it would have been another project that was funded from Free State Government. But this particular case revolves around the asbestos deal. Now, the asbestos deal was a 255 million rand project where people were appointed to go out and inspect houses and to interview the residents of houses that were built during a certain period of time to ascertain whether those houses were safe to live in. And the person that was appointed and the person who's been before the Zondo Commission, who then subcontracted Zondi, has now come out with various allegations. And in terms of the way in which it was awarded and where the ultimate responsibility lies, which would have been with the Premier of the province at the time, they are claiming that the 255 million rand asbestos deal was a deal that was created merely as a means to an end to take funds out of the Free State Treasury. And this is what we've seen. This is something that the public hasn't quite wrapped their mind around, is that there were certain projects, and I'm not saying this is one of them, I'm generalizing, but I just want to give a little bit of insight into what we believe happened. Projects were created so that certain people could be appointed so that monies could be taken out of that project and used to look after certain individuals down the chain of command. And what we've also seen is that certain projects were created to be able to fund certain aspects or issues that needed funding. So I'll give you an example. The ANC is a massive, massive organization. And when one looks at what happened in 1990 when the party was unbanned, people were coming from overseas, people were coming out of exile, people were coming out of the townships from the SDUs. All of these people had contributed something towards the liberation struggle. A lot of them were deployed into the public sector where they took up jobs within government departments. Some of them were deployed to local government, to provincial government, to national government. But in a lot of instances, there wasn't enough work to go around to reward these people for what they had done within the struggle. And you must always remember Smatsu Binyama, who said he wasn't in the struggle to be poor. So businesses were created. And these businesses were created to enable a transformation, and the agenda was good. The idea of having broad-based black economic empowerment and affirmative action was good. It wasn't just for members of the Liberation Party. It was also for people who had been disenfranchised and had been kept out of the job market due to their color. And this was a wonderful policy, but it didn't work fast enough and it didn't create enough jobs. And it also did not create an area of funding that was needed for electioneering and to pay for a very top-heavy head office staff of a political party. You must understand that the party itself employs a lot of people. We're talking about the ANC in particular here. They employ a lot of people that are there to go out and canvass votes. They're there for electioneering. They're there to ensure that the people on the ground understand that the party exists, what the party stands for, to remind them of the existence of the party, what the party's done for them. And all of this has a cost implication. And although the IEC allocates a certain amount of funds to each and every political party that has representation in South Africa, it's not sufficient. There's not enough money in the coffers of the party to pay all the people that are involved. Right. So they have to find ways of money. Raising so what money. Would normally happen, and this is where the great concern comes in, and this is when it becomes gratification. This is where it becomes a corrupt relationship. And this is why we have an act of parliament known as PRECA, the Prevention Combat of Corrupt Activities Act. Where it becomes an issue is where you give somebody business. They may, from government, be it local, provincial, or national, they may be capable, they may not be capable. But the point I'm making is that part of the understanding when giving them that work is that they are going to become donors to the party. So what you found at the at the Zondo Commission is that a lot of people that receive tenders to do certain projects were also donors to the party, and that a certain percentage of funds that were derived from these different projects would go back to the party. And they would go back to the party to fund salaries, to fund electioneering, to fund campaigns, to fund the rental of stadiums, to pay for posters, to pay for T-shirts, and so on and so forth. And herein lies the massive problem. That in itself is what defines gratification. It means that somebody who is politically connected, and because he's a donor to a certain party, starts receiving business. And the bigger problem lies in the fact that when you've got a lot of people to look after because you've been given a contract or a tender, you would never be able to execute the mandate of that tender correctly because there's just not enough funds to do it. And that is why we now looking at all these different issues. And
so this was almost inevitable. Case, I mean, it's almost
a groundbreaking
inevitable.
Case.
So this case is just one of a series of cases against him.
It's a series of cases that may be brought against him. Obviously, the Frieda Dairy is something that everybody's looking at. It's something that we can see was used to monetize the Guptas. We saw how monies were diverted and circulated and landed up in some instances paying for a part of the infamous wedding that took place at Sun City.
Yes.
But this particular matter that he's been arrested for is the asbestos deal, which was in relation to the inspection of houses to see whether they were safe for humans to live in.
Chad, just in terms of process, with this now there's this warrant out for his arrest. What happens next?
He will present himself to the authorities on Friday. They will then process him because there is a warrant. By processing him, what it means is they will then take his fingerprints. They will formally charge him. He will be booked in and out of the cells. It's just a process. He'll be booked in and out of the cells. He'll then be taken to court. He'll be held in the holding cells at the court. He'll then be brought up to the dock, and he will then have the charges put to him, and they will then determine bail. Because it's prearranged, I can't see bail being opposed in this regard, and the matter will then be set down for a further date. So that's the process that's in place.
And how long would it take for this now to come before a court in order for it to proceed?
You sound like every single complainant in South Africa. And the sad truth of the story is that there's an expression which I hate, but it's how long is a piece of string? Every case is different. It depends how prepared the state is. It depends how many times the case is delayed, either for further investigation or witnesses are unavailable or somebody is sick and they can't appear in court or they decide to change attorneys. You can stall the process. Conversely, for an accused, if the state isn't ready and if the state carries on asking for postponements, the accused can bring forward an application in court to have
to
the matter withdrawn based on the fact that the Constitution enshrines their right to a speedy trial. It doesn't apply the other way. All that can happen is that the presiding officer can get frustrated, and because so many people have been sick, or because there's been so many lawyers that have been changed, or because he sees their stalling tactics at play, the presiding officer then says, there are no more postponements. This is the final postponement. The matter set down for trial. You can't afford legal counsel, or you want to change legal counsel. Too bad. We'll appoint legal aid for you. These people who are sick, I want their doctors here. I want to know exactly what's wrong with them. And then the matter will proceed. But in terms of trial, maybe 6 months from now, maybe 9 months from now, there's still the opportunity for a negotiated settlement, for a plea to be done. There's a plea arrangement that can be done in terms of Section 105A. Of the Criminal Procedure Act. There's a sanction that can be applied where you pay back monies in terms of Section 297 or Section 300 of the Criminal Procedure Act. POCA may come into play, which is the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, which is based on the American RICO Act, where the asset forfeiture unit go out and get a temporary restraint, which we refer to as a preservation order over assets. There's a lot that's going to happen in the next couple of months. But this is the first and most important step. And I think they've done it before the end of the year to show that we promised we were going to bring in some big names. We've brought in a couple of people to now. You as the public don't seem content enough. We have a case. this is what we're doing. And it's been in the wings. This isn't something that they're springing on the public just for the publicity aspect of it. We've known this is going to happen. It's now finally happened, but we hope the momentum stays.
And in terms of the law, it's conceivable that the next case and the next case, further warrants for his arrest in different cases can be brought all whilst this is happening.
Yes, like we saw with Agrizi. Agrizi was brought in based on the alleged Basasa corruption. And then the warrant was issued for the corruption involving a parliamentarian. So that was a separate case. They're not running concurrently. They haven't been consolidated in terms of the act. They're two separate cases. So it can become a point where you just see people being picked up on different cases, and sometimes you see the same faces in and out of court. And eventually it reaches a point where either the state determines that there is a common thread that runs between these cases that enables them to consolidate it in terms of Section 81(1) of the Criminal Procedure Act, or they're going to try each case separately. I can't see them trying multiple cases separately. It's going to have to reach a point where they're going to have to start looking at consolidating. Mm-hmm. There's just not enough resources at this point in time to have multiple cases in multiple jurisdictions.
And unfortunately, we are out of time. Kim says, love this guy, making such sense of the madness. Thank you for having him on. I'm really loving this. I would love him to stay for 3 hours. Well, we can't do that, unfortunately. Chad Thomas, CEO of IRS Forensic Investigations, thank you for your time and your incredibly clear explanation. I'm going to tell you not to go too far, because we're going to be having you back over the next few weeks to help us try and understand what is going on.